Iraq boils again in a familiar flashpoint. Today, Tuesday, January 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Violence flares in Fallujah, and for many Iraqis, it's pulling up painful memories.
The Battle of Fallujah in 2004 made actually a scar in the collective memory of the population.
The new violence is also upsetting this American veteran.
To someone who spent 28 months of his life in Iraq, watched a couple dozen of my soldiers get killed and all the blood and treasure expended, you know, it's deeply, deeply disappointing.
Plus, lingering questions about that ship trapped in the Antarctic ice and the expensive rescue.
This is mostly sort of boutique science versus quote-unquote serious science, and the serious scientists just feel like this wouldn't have had to happen.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Headlines for Iraq today, they could have been written a few years ago. An assault on Fallujah is delayed because of fears about civilian casualties. Or an airstrike in Ramadi reportedly kills 25 al-Qaeda insurgents. The difference is that now U.S. troops are not involved. Those headlines I just recapped describe the battle that's raging right now in Iraq's western Anbar province between the Shiite-dominated Iraqi government and insurgents in the majority Sunni region. The BBC's Rafid Jabouri is in Baghdad. He says the current fighting stems from a long-running power struggle between Iraq's Shiite and Sunni politicians.
Although this country is governed by a power-sharing agreement, a government of national unity where Sunnis are actually represented in power, but they're complaining that they don't have a say over security affairs and accuse Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki of leading the armed forces alone and discriminating against them. Of course, the Shia would say something different, the Shia majority in this country. There is actually, I have to say, an overwhelming support for the army's operation in western Iraq among the Shia.
Right. So the local residents there, who are they siding with, the Iraqi government or al-Qaeda insurgents?
Again, we are talking about a Sunni population, a Sunni community of Iraq. In general, they oppose the government of Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki. In general, they supported the protest movement that started in 2012, influenced by what happened across the Middle East region, where we saw regimes being toppled by mass protests. However, many of them were scared to see the al-Qaeda militants taking control of two major cities in their province last week. That's when some key tribal leaders decided to fight al-Qaeda, not the Iraqi government.
Right. So some people fighting al-Qaeda, some people fighting the government. And on top of that, I'm hearing a lot of Fallujah residents are fleeing in fear of a government onslaught to take the city back. I mean, it sounds completely chaotic.
It is chaotic. We believe that there is an imminent offensive to retake al-Qaeda. Just yesterday, the Iraqi Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki made a plea to the residents of Fallujah to drive al-Qaeda out in order to avoid a major offensive to retake the city. So far, we haven't seen any positive response to that. Again, this is the city, the Fallujah we're talking about here, a very tribal community with conservative traditions and with many officers in the former Iraqi army of the former President Saddam Hussein with anti-government sentiments.
Fallujah, I'm sure you can't forget, was nearly destroyed during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Fierce battles there. Have the residents rebuilt the city? I mean, was there a sense, has there been a sense of renewed hope there?
When I visited Fallujah last time, last year, there were, of course, signs of the fighting that took place in 2004, some of the most intense fighting that the U.S. Forces had since Vietnam. But there were also some reconstruction and, I have to say, even some hope for a better future with the stability that followed. But again, the Battle of Fallujah in 2004 made actually a scar in the collective memory of the population. You know, if you compare them, for example, to neighboring Ramadi, which also fell into a significant part of it fell to the hands of al-Qaeda, Fallujah looks even more extremist, more radical in terms of dealing with the Shia-led government. While in Ramadi, the Shia-led government of Prime Minister Maliki found some allies in the tribes who decided to fight al-Qaeda. Nothing like that is happening in Fallujah so far.
The BBC's Rafid Jabouri in Baghdad, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Pete Mansour is pretty familiar with Fallujah and Anbar province. Mansour is a soldier, and not just any soldier. He helped shape the counterinsurgency strategy that turned the Iraq War around for the U.S. He was founding director of the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Center at Fort Leavenworth. And Mansour went on to put his theories to the test as executive officer to General David Petraeus during the surge in 2007. He has a new book out called Surge, and I asked him what he made of the latest wave of violence in Iraq.
It's very disappointing to someone who spent 28 months of his life in Iraq, watched a couple dozen of my soldiers get killed and all the blood and treasure expended. You know, it's deeply, deeply disappointing that Al-Anbar and other portions of Iraq have spiraled downward the way they have in recent months.
Do you point the finger at anybody in particular or any kind of mistake made along the way for what's happening now?
Primarily, this is the fault of a sectarian prime minister, but also the fault of an administration in Washington that didn't really want to remain engaged in Iraq.
I'm sure you've seen the polls. I mean, most Americans are pretty happy to be disengaged from Iraq, but I'm just wondering, I mean, as a veteran, do you feel the sacrifices of your comrades was in vain?
Not perhaps in vain, because I'm not sure that Al-Qaeda is going to succeed in what they're doing right now, but I have a different view. I realize that Americans wanted to be done with the war, but I really think that had we remained engaged, both with a reduced amount of military forces and more politically engaged as well, that we could have prevented this sort of backsliding from taking place.
I don't suppose you would support going back and kind of finishing things up at this point.
No, I think at this point that's water under the bridge. You know, it's a no-go-back game. It's not like Monopoly where you can return to go and collect $200 and move on. At this point, we're going to have to do the best we can without U.S. forces on the ground.
We're just hearing today that the Iraqi government says 25 al-Qaeda militants have been killed in Anbar. Do you think Nouri al-Maliki is now taking things under control and doing what needs to be done?
Well, he's trying, but you know, as I show in my book, what turned Anbar province around and Iraq in general was far more than just targeted operations to kill and capture insurgents, which it seems that's all he's doing right now.
So you're saying that the Iraqi government right now is more reactive than proactive?
Very reactive. And they've turned away some of the tribes that were such a significant part of the turnaround in Anbar in 2006 and 2007 and beyond. The Abu Risha clan, for instance, the initial tribe that allied with U.S. forces in Ramadi, it's been sidelined by the government. I think this is the wrong way to go about it. These are people that he's going to need on his side.
I mean, the Iraqi government does have support of one of the biggest tribes in the area, don't they?
Yeah, the Dilemi Confederation, and it's certainly an important one, but again, you want all of them on your side if you can, and it doesn't make any sense to alienate any of them if you can help it.
How do you even go about approaching a tribe? I mean, who do you call?
Well, first you have to figure out who are the tribal sheikhs, who are the leaders, and you do a cultural reconnaissance. You go and start talking to people. You know, the folks on the ground understand who the movers and shakers are, and you quickly can figure it out.
How do you actually win influence over tribes? I mean, whether you're an outsider from the capital, Iraqi outsiders or American outsiders?
Well, General Petraeus used to like to say that Iraqi tribes are like reruns of The Sopranos. They all have a construction company, a trucking company, and an import-export business. And you win support by giving them things and by making deals. You know, it's business to them. We won support by giving them reconstruction contracts, by training their young men to become policemen. And it was a quid pro quo. In return, they gave us intelligence and offered security services in their neighborhoods. So it's not that hard. It's just common business dealings. It just happens that the business includes war fighting.
So back to the big picture. I mean, if you lay some of the blame for this uprising on Obama's desk, I mean, what should the U.S. be doing about it?
Well, at this point, we have to work with Maliki and try to moderate his sectarian political behavior. That is much easier said than done, because we've lost a lot of our leverage in Iraq by the withdrawal of our troops. But we still have a lot of leverage.
Pete Mansour, the author of a new book called Surge, My Journey with General David Petraeus and the Remaking of the Iraq War. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, remember when Iran and Israel were not enemies? I don't. You probably don't either. But before the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the two countries were trading partners and quietly cooperated on defense projects. There were also some cultural ties, and that's what this next story is about. It's this week's Sideways Glance, the stories that make us do a double take. A celebrated Iranian author traveled to Israel in the 1960s and wrote about his visit. From Jerusalem, here's Daniel Estrin.
In 1961, an eager 25-year-old Israeli diplomat was sent on his first mission abroad, to Tehran. Tzvi Rafiach would go to parties at the homes of Iranian writers and painters and intellectuals and schmooze and see if he could get any of them to visit Israel. And at one party, he met Jalal Ali Ahmad. He was one of Iran's most influential authors and thinkers, and he was curious about Israel.
And I said to myself, that's the guy, because he talks to people, he mingles with people, people listen to him, people take him seriously. If he goes to Israel and come back and has good impression, that's what we want as diplomat.
In 1963, Rafiach arranged an all-expenses-paid trip to Israel for Ali Ahmad. The author was in Israel for 2 weeks, and he wrote a travelogue about his journey. Recently, an American-Israeli academic named Samuel Thrope found out about Ali Ahmad's book and was intrigued. So he translated it from Persian into English. The translation, called The Israeli Republic, came out last month.
He loved the kibbutz. He loved Zionism. I mean, he has all kinds of reservations about the Zionist project and the Jewish state. But at least in the beginning, he was so enthusiastic. He was drawn to it.
The Iranian author went to Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust memorial. He did a little sightseeing. But he was perhaps most excited about visiting a kibbutz, an Israeli collective farm. He actually thought Iran should adopt the model of the kibbutz, Thrope says.
The confluence of tradition and socialism and agriculture and the cultural revolution inherent in the idea of, you know, these Jewish agricultural Hebrew-speaking collectives, those were all things which he wanted to see in Iranian culture, the revolutionary and radical ideals behind them.
It may sound surprising, but he thought Israel as a Jewish spiritual homeland was a model for an Islamic utopia. He calls Israel a vilayat, a Shiite term meaning a guardianship. The Islamic Republic was based on that principle, that religious clerics should be guardians of society. That's not the only unusual thing about this book. In the epilogue, the author changes his tune. He lashes out at Israel. Tzvi Rafiach, the Israeli diplomat who sent the author to Israel, just read his book for the first time in its English translation, and he says he's perplexed.
I only regretted I didn't have a chance to clarify with him why is he so adamantly and why is he using those, in my view, anti-Semitic. I mean, you don't have to go from one extreme to the other.
Some believe the last chapter is a forgery written by Ali Ahmad's brother, who published the author's work after he died, the idea being that he added the criticism to make the book acceptable in Iran's new Islamic Republic. Today, almost no intellectuals from Arab and Muslim countries visit Israel, and vice versa. Jalal Ali Ahmad's book isn't a blueprint for peace between Israel and Iran, but it does remind us that there was a time when Israelis and Iranians could be tourists in each other's lands. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Warring factions in South Sudan may have taken a small step towards peace. The two sides actually sat down today for peace talks in Ethiopia. So far, they don't have much to show for it. The talks hit a bump right away over rebel demands that the government release several supporters of former Vice President Riek Machar. South Sudan's government blames him for starting the violence, which so far has killed more than 1,000 people and driven hundreds of thousands from their homes. Gail Smith is a senior director at the National Security Council and one of President Obama's advisors on South Sudan.
This is a part of Africa centered right in the heart of East Africa and the Horn, where neither we nor the people of the region can afford to have a failed state. And it's a fragile country to begin with. It's newly independent. South Sudan and the people of South Sudan have lived most of their lives in war until they achieved independence a couple of years ago.
And where do oil interests come into play, and specifically China's domination of that South Sudanese and Sudan market? Does that concern the U.S.?
China has vast interests in oil in Africa and has been very assertive in trying to acquire as much oil as they can from the continent. I don't think that plays in this conflict in particular at all.
You don't?
I mean, it's a factor in the sense that Riek Machar's forces and government forces are fighting in the areas where South Sudan's oil is found. That will be a nice patch of territory for either side to grab a hold of. But it's not a driver of the conflict in any sense.
Do you think China could or even should be playing a bigger role in getting parties to the table?
I think China could play a very important role. And they have, I mean, what they have said publicly is that the parties need to negotiate politically. I think hearing more of that from China would be very helpful.
So U.S. officials, as you know, played a key role in helping South Sudan split from the North, and the Obama White House was proud of helping to usher in the newest nation in the world 2 years ago. But now government soldiers in South Sudan and rebels, they're killing their own citizens. I mean, does that make you think any differently about the role the U.S. has played there?
No, I think, in fact, if you look at the U.S. role, it's really quite interesting. You can go back 20 years and there's a long history of successive administrations, members of Congress, both parties, both houses, students, faith-based groups across the country, working very arduously for a very, very long time in support of the rights of the people of South Sudan. I don't think that we would in any way say that because what has happened over the last 3 weeks, their right to self-determination or to vote in a referendum wasn't a valid one. It certainly was. I think the challenge, again, that we're facing is after pretty much straight conflict from 1955 till it reached independence, a lack of development, weak institutions, we are seeing the vulnerabilities of what people commonly refer to as fragile states, and we're making every investment we can in trying to bring this conflict to a quick end and focus on what will be the very, very, very difficult process of political negotiations.
How close is the White House watching these allegations of people being killed based on ethnic group that they belong to?
Very, very, very closely. That's very much in the forefront of everybody's mind. And again, it's one of the reasons that this conflict is so terribly, terribly dangerous and why we and everyone else are pushing very hard on all the parties, whatever their disputes may be, to solve them politically rather than militarily, because it has unleashed a current of ethnic violence that could spiral well out of control. So we're very focused on that.
Gail Smith, the Senior Director for Global Development and Humanitarian Issues at the National Security Council. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, here's a number you might want to remember, 42. It's not a secret code, but it does mean a lot to coders, computer coders, in France anyway. 42 is the name of a new school for code writers in Paris. It's free, doesn't give grades, and it may just start cranking out some of the best programmers in the world. Reporter Jerry Haddon spent a day at 42 and sent us his story.
No grades? 42 doesn't even have classes or teachers in the traditional sense. What it does have, lots of computers. 1,000 brand new Macintosh computer screens stand on rows of desks in 42's enormous open workspaces. A 22-year-old student named Théo Unibla shows up at noon for day 3 of 42's inaugural school year.
On n'a pas d'heure de cours à proprement dit. Là, cet après-midi, on a vite fait une sorte de cours.
We don't have schedules, he says. In the afternoon, we'll have a meeting about our next project. We'll be upstairs, sitting on the floor, as usual. That's how it is here. Getting here in the middle of the day is fine, but not everything goes. Unibla sets down his backpack at a workstation, shakes a colleague awake, and tries to explain to me why you'd even call this a school. It's a little bit like a cult, he says, but at the same time, it's all very open. They call it peer-to-peer learning. You learn to work in teams. You share everything you learn. If not, you're lost. Authorities in France are not very happy about 42. It's a private school, so you might think, what's the big deal? Private schools can make up all the rules, or lack of rules, they want. But France's education ministry, the teachers' unions, they're all bashing it, upset that an untested, unaccredited, and free school could draw away so many of their potential students. Judging by 42's first round of applicants, the establishment's angst is understandable. This summer, 70,000 candidates applied. 4,000 finalists were then invited to the pool, not the swimming kind. They moved into the half-finished school itself, camping on the floor, sharing communal bathrooms, working 15 high-octane hours a day, 7 days a week, for a month. The lights never turn off, one candidate laughed in this French TV report. It's never night inside here, and it's always noisy. Someone's always snoring or moving around. 800 people made the cut. It was their first taste of 42's teaching methods. No theory, no traditional rote learning. 42 is hands-on, project-oriented, like the real world, which is the school's main draw, says co-founder Nicolas Sadirac. At the moment, France needs tens of thousands of IT specialists, he says. But graduates from traditional schools increasingly lack the experience modern companies expect.
The problem is that the world has changed. And now the French education system has a very hard time to adapt. It's slow. And we are now in a world competition about digital world. And we are fifth economy in the standard way, and we are 25th in the digital economy.
42 wants to reverse that trend. Lest anyone doubt the brain power Sadirac's gathered in this three-story building, during the month-long tryout, some students hacked into Apple's latest operating system, called Mavericks, on a lark.
What happened? Did you tell Mac about this?
Or? Yeah, Mac, it's already patched, and it's part of the new release of macOS.
Of Mavericks?
Yeah.
Wow. So thanks to your students.
Yeah, one month after opening.
This place is more dangerous than the NSA.
Not yet.
Des nerds, des geeks. La plupart, il y en a beaucoup, beaucoup qui sont ici.
We're nerds, says Winterbla. Geeks. A lot of us here come from the world of video games. Others are designers for webs and apps. And some have no coding experience at all. Cue more gasps from the establishment. Oh, and if you're wondering why the school is called 42, for those of you who aren't geeks, 42 is from the Douglas Adams novel, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The number represents the answer to everything, calculated by a supercomputer working over millions of years. For Unerbla and the other students, the bar's been set high. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon at 42 in Paris.
News headlines are next. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, remembering the life and work of Hong Kong film mogul Run Run Shaw. You may not recognize his name, but he definitely changed what you and I see on the big screen.
Without him and without the martial arts in cinema that he was able to bring to the forefront, we wouldn't have films like The Matrix.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Just 30 days now until the Winter Olympic Games officially open in Sochi. And today, Russian authorities began, in a sense, locking down the resort town on the Black Sea and all the surrounding Olympic venues. Tens of thousands of security forces will be watching over the entire area. Massive security precautions have become commonplace at the Olympics, but in Russia, after two recent suicide bombings in the city of Volgograd, security is being taken very, very seriously. Michael Payne is an advisor to global sports events. He's also the former head of marketing for the International Olympic Committee. So the risks are clear, Michael. How do you actually balance, though, selling the Olympics as this great once-in-a-lifetime sporting event in light of those risks?
Well, as you say, the risks are clear, and unfortunately, for the last 40 years, ever since the Munich Olympic Games, there has always been the threat of terrorism, such as the media profile of the Olympic Games. It gives a platform for different organizations to make a statement. And that's why security has probably been the number one issue of every organizer and host country. But I don't think that the Russian Organizing Committee is necessarily doing anything different than London did a couple of years ago, or even America, you know, when you think back to Salt Lake just shortly after 9/11. It is a balancing act, though, between making sure that the athletes and the visitors are all protected, but equally that you don't let the security suffocate the very special atmosphere of the Olympic Games.
So how do you do that? I mean, how do you actually make security palatable during the Olympics?
I remember in Beijing, about 3 weeks before the Games, I met with the leadership of the organizing committee, and I congratulated them and said, look, everything is ready. You have nothing to worry about. But if I may, just one word of advice. And they all looked at me, you know, nervously and said, what's that? And I said, the word is smile. Because I just walked into your offices, I had to clear through security, and it was a little bit intimidating. If you were to train the soldiers to smile and welcome, you will completely transform the atmosphere. And I'm told a few days later they had 20,000 soldiers on the parade ground teaching them how to smile. Mm-hmm. But by the time all the guests came, you had a very warm welcome from the security staff.
I mean, that may have been a good marching order for London and Beijing. I would say less easy to smile in Sochi after these bombings in Volgograd. I mean, have you ever seen an Olympics where the risks were so pronounced and stark?
I mean, yes. I mean, if you think, I mean, people forget there was a major terrorist incident in northwest China about a month before the Games. London, the day after its election, 40 people were killed on the underground. So the security threat and challenges, particularly in, you know, what they would call the public domain outside of the venues, it has always been a major challenge.
I mean, the Kremlin's been trumpeting these thousands of troops today, just a month away from the Games. Does that inspire confidence in you?
Sadly, it's the nature of the world and the environment we live in. And what the Russians are doing is identical to the hosts of, you know, the last 10 Olympic Games. The security doesn't start the week before the Games. The security measures on the Olympics are, you know, in place the moment construction starts. You know, I'm going to Sochi for 2 weeks. I was actually a lot more nervous going to London because of the challenges of locking down a whole city. In the case of Sochi, they are, because of its a fairly small footprint, able to lock down a complete city. But obviously the broader risk and threat is going to be what is happening throughout the country, as to whether there, you know, is a repeat of the tragic incident in Volgograd. But I think Sochi itself will be very secure.
And for the Russians, the advice is still smile, smile, smile.
I think it's important, and I think they would certainly be advised and encouraged by the IOC to making sure that there is a complete lockdown and secure position, but also then finding a way to do that so that it doesn't come across as a completely militaristic environment, that there is still a friendly approach. And whether it's, you know, trading Olympic pins with the security staff or just the welcome, I'm sure that they are already carefully looking at the balance so that the special atmosphere isn't suffocated.
Michael Payne, former head of marketing for the IOC, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was a story that captivated people around the world. You know the one, a research vessel with scientists, tourists, journalists, and a Russian crew get stuck in pack ice in the Antarctic on Christmas Day. It takes multiple attempts by various countries to rescue the passengers of the Akademik Shokalsky. And finally, after a week of waiting, they're evacuated by a Chinese helicopter to an Australian icebreaker. Here's BBC journalist Andrew Luck Baker reporting on the day that he and 51 others were airlifted to safety.
Look at that. What a handsome craft that is.
It was the sight everyone had been waiting for. The first rescue helicopter descending onto the same ice that had kept me and all on board the Russian research ship, the Akademik Shokalsky, stranded for over a week.
The first of the helicopters to take us home!
Thanks, everyone!
So the research scientists are safe, the tourists and journalists are safe, and now the weather has improved and the Russian crew still aboard the Shokalsky have been able to get the vessel moving through the ice. But that's not the end of the story. Andy Revkin writes the .earth blog for the New York Times. Now, you've written in your blog, Andy, that you've heard from polar scientists who say their own important and costly research in Antarctica was seriously disrupted by this diversion of icebreakers and the attempts to evacuate the passengers who were on an unessential expedition. That sounds like pretty harsh criticism of this expedition.
Well, scientists involved with years-long projects in Antarctica are very upset that they're not upset that, you know, a rescue effort had to be made and that ships were removed. They're upset that the basic need for it was the result of an expedition that they see as kind of frivolous. There's a sense of big stuff, federally funded French, American, and probably Chinese operations that require a lot of stuff to be done in a very short window of time when the ships can come and go. The Polar Star, which is now on its way to free the Chinese icebreaker, which sent the helicopter that rescued the people from the ship. The Polar Star is supposed to be clearing ice at McMurdo, the big American international Antarctic base, and it's not because of this Operation Spirit of Mawson.
So there's kind of a knock-on effect for other scientists in the region.
Yeah, and then that all gets delayed, and it's also costly. And, you know, I've been on four different Arctic trips. I've not been to Antarctica because logistically it's challenging for journalists or scientists. But when you're on a National Science Foundation project, everything is vetted for safety. There's multiple layers of making sure things are going to work okay. And so I think the grump factor is that this operation seemed to take place in a bay, Commonwealth Bay, where there was an unusual amount of sea ice around. It was kind of not unexpected that you could have this kind of event transpire.
So when scientists are on board these special trips with journalists and tourists, is there science kind of for show? Is it for the benefit of those other people on board?
You know, the tourists who came along are basically helping to finance the trip itself. So it's enabling the scientists to be there and do their work. And again, as I said in my post on Dot Earth, there are graduate students along for whom this is a really, you know, sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There's certainly educational value, but the question is, was it worth taking the risk to have this kind of expedition into a bay where any satellite image could show you was kind of surrounded by sea ice that could move? This is mostly sort of boutique science versus quote-unquote serious science. And the serious scientists just feel like this wouldn't have had to happen if it hadn't been for this sort of what they consider a frivolous operation.
Let me ask you about a debate that's transpired since the ship got stuck in ice. A lot of climate change deniers have been jumping on the fact that this expedition got stuck in ice as evidence that climate change is bogus. So what is the science behind what's going on with this muscular ice down there?
Well, Antarctica is a very different place than the Arctic. Sea ice in the Arctic Ocean is all hemmed in on both sides by all the continents that ring the Arctic Ocean. Antarctica is a continent that's ringed by ocean. So the dynamics of sea ice there are very different than they are in the Arctic. So making comparisons between why Arctic sea ice, the top of the world, is retreating and Antarctic sea ice is expanding, it doesn't really work from the beginning.
Andy, what about the argument that little is gained by reenacting historic expeditions? This one was called the Spirit of Mawson, was reenacting a voyage about a century ago of Douglas Mawson.
There's nothing wrong with these projects as long as they're kind of self-sustaining, responsibly carried out with safeguards and, you know, keeping track of things like sea ice conditions. If you're on your own and you kind of do something silly, that's one thing. If you're on your own, you do something silly and it affects large operations that are important to basic understanding of how the world works and is changing, then that's problematic.
Andy Revkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times, thank you.
Good to be with you.
In Africa, one reason the AIDS virus spreads so widely is a cultural practice common in some areas, older men having sexual relations with much younger women. Experts say this enabled HIV to move quickly from one generation to the next. Schools in Africa have tried to educate girls about the risks of these relationships, and yet they persist. The world's Anders Kelto found out why while spending time this past year at a public high school in Cape Town. The school is called the Center of Science and Technology, or COSAT. Here's Anders.
Seema, that's not her real name, was until recently a junior at COSAT. She lives in a small, dilapidated house in a sprawling urban township. She says most nights, she and her siblings go to bed hungry.
We don't have food at home. We just drink water and go to sleep.
Her mother works part-time as a cleaner, and her father is unemployed. She says her parents fight all the time.
I wish I could just go away. Not be with them while they are fighting and all that.
A few months ago, she was visiting her older sister, who lives a few blocks away. Seema was washing clothes near the road when a man approached her. She thought he looked stylish.
I saw, oh, that's an interesting guy, and got attracted to him as much as he got attracted to me.
She gave the man her phone number. He called her that night. The next thing Seema knew, they were dating. She didn't know the man's age, but guessed he was in his mid-20s. Seema is 16. Seema had been warned about relationships like this. At her high school, COSAT, she and her classmates had been told to watch out for so-called sugar daddies.
A sugar daddy is like an older guy who's a boyfriend to a younger girl.
That's Nosy Piwo, a junior, taking part in a classroom discussion. Another girl, Sihle, chimed in. She said that these relationships aren't healthy.
You don't expect to be the only one in that sugar daddy. There can be like five of you in that same guy.
And that means a high risk of HIV, she said. In fact, studies have shown that the rate of HIV among school-aged girls in South Africa is nearly three times higher than among school-aged boys. The reason for the gap, South Africa's Minister of Health said last year, is sugar daddies. That was the message the girls were supposed to be getting in this class, that dating older men is risky. But instead, a lot of girls spoke about the benefits of these relationships. Here's Zetu, a junior.
Sometimes it's nice to have a sugar daddy because you live a fancy life, you wear posh clothes, like, and people will notice you, like, hey, this girl.
When the class ended, I spoke with the teacher, Miss Bakwana. She said she often has a hard time convincing girls to end relationships with older men.
It really gets difficult to get through to young people to stop that.
She said after years of counseling students, she's come to a rather chilling realization that most girls know what they're getting themselves into.
They do see the risks, but they're prepared to take them.
Seema is a case in point. After being approached by the stylish man near her sister's house, she started spending a lot of time with him, despite having been warned of the risks. She says she could tell that some people judged her harshly, staring at her and making snide remarks.
Sometimes you just wish you could put the person who is judging you into your shoes, and he or she can feel how hot your shoes are.
After all, she says, the older man was giving her love and support, unlike her father. For her, the relationship meant food, clothes, and a comfortable place to stay. But the relationship interfered with other aspects of her life. Seema began missing school. It was then that Miss Bakwana, the teacher from COSAT, stepped in. She arranged to give Seema some money, thinking that might pull her out of the relationship.
She got support from school. She was given groceries at some point.
But it didn't work. Seema stopped showing up for classes altogether. Miss Bakwana says she felt like she had done everything she could.
Which really saddens me as an educator, because I feel that I cannot do anything.
Meanwhile, Seema says she had fallen in love with the man. She was finally enjoying her life. But then he called her and said he was moving.
He told me that the next day he's going to Pretoria and he has the tickets and everything. I was so shocked and could not believe that. I rushed to take a taxi and went right straight at him and asked, how could you do that? Are you just now leaving me just like that? Just going away and leaving me with all the loneliness.
The man didn't say much. He was sorry. He would call her. But Seema was devastated, and she had missed so much school that she got expelled. She had to move in with her parents again.
It's back to that normal life, that old life, and I don't want to go back there.
Seema says she's trying to pull her life back together. She's hoping to re-enroll in school this year. She thinks she should probably avoid relationships for a while. But she says, honestly, if she's approached by an older man again, she's not sure what she'll do. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto, Cape Town.
You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We had journalist Glenn Greenwald on the show recently. I asked him for his thoughts on a New York Times editorial that supported clemency for Edward Snowden. Greenwald has worked with Snowden to publish his leaks on the NSA's vast spying operations, and Greenwald thought the Times editorial made a convincing case for clemency. Fred Kaplan disagrees. The Slate columnist wrote about Snowden recently, applauding some of his leaks, but Kaplan says Snowden went too far to be considered a whistleblower.
What I don't applaud is his massive leaks, his massive stealing of documents and leaking of those documents concerning legitimate NSA activities.
Well, we spoke with Glenn Greenwald, as I said earlier, and got his reaction to the New York Times editorial on Snowden. Not surprisingly, he liked it and framed it this way. Let's hear what he had to say.
So it really brought the idea not only that Snowden deserved clemency, but that he's really a heroic whistleblower who has done a great service for his country, as the Times said, into mainstream thought.
So, Fred Kaplan, do you feel like it's harder to dismiss what Edward Snowden did now that that paper of historical record threw its weight behind him?
No. I don't consider that at all. I have a feeling that there was a pretty intense debate in the editorial pages of the New York Times whether to do that. I would say that there are conditions that I would support Edward Snowden if he came back reducing his sentence or getting into a plea bargain situation. But one thing that he would have to do is to clear up some mysteries. For example, why did he go to Hong Kong? And then why did he go to Moscow? Is it true, as has been reported in the Russian press, that the 3 days that he disappeared from Hong Kong after leaving the hotel, that he spent those days in the Russian consulate? What did he do in the Russian consulate?
What would you like to see happen to Edward Snowden?
Number one, I really don't care, fundamentally. Number two, this could come to a head. I mean, you know, he has a one-year visa in Moscow, in Russia. Putin has a lot of leverage over Snowden when this 1 year expires. Will he keep him in Russia under certain circumstances in exchange for certain knowledge? Or will he say, Starry, you're no longer welcome here. You have to go. It'll be very difficult for any other country to pick him up. And then he returns to the United States. And as I say in my column, I would be very much in favor of a reduced sentence, which is one of the options that the New York Times editorial also endorsed. My condition would be that he fess up completely on, you know, whether he gave any of this information to the Russian or Chinese government. I think if he wants to be considered for some kind of reduced sentence, he has to come completely clean on what he did, why he did it, and what he's done in the months since he left the United States.
You wrote this column, Why Snowden Won't and Should Not Get Clemency. I'm kind of shocked to hear you say you don't care fundamentally what happens to him.
No, I don't. I don't think he's the issue. Personally.
What is the issue?
I mean, if he ends up staying in Russia for the rest of his life, I mean, I guess thinking about it a little bit, I guess it'd be a little bit better if he came back here, if that would ensure that no further secrets about foreign operations is let out, if some kind of deal can be made. But you know, I'm interested more in the effects of this than in what happens to him personally.
Fred Kaplan, who is a columnist with Slate, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, we're going to remember a man you might never have heard of, but you've almost certainly seen one of his movies. The world's Nina Porzucchi has his story.
He was the father, or grandfather, or really, I should say, great-grandfather of Hong Kong cinema, Run Run Shaw. He was a Hong Kong entertainment mogul, one half of Shaw Brothers Studio, and the head of Television Broadcast Limited. Shaw died this morning at the impressive age of 106, quite a feat considering that the kind of films he was famous for were, well, pretty violent.
We wouldn't have Chow Yun-fat today. We wouldn't have Andy Lau today. None of the big stars. I mean, the face of Hong Kong cinema would be completely unrecognizable without him.
James Marsh is a freelance film critic based in Hong Kong. And while Run Run Shaw is responsible for producing more than 1,000 films of all sorts, including Blade Runner, Marsh says what he's most famous for is sparking the kung fu craze of the 1970s. Run Run Shaw was born Xiao Yifu in 1907 in China. He got his nickname from his father. It was a pun on the word rickshaw. At 19, Shaw traveled to Singapore with his brother Run Mi Shaw, where they opened up a chain of movie theaters. It was a pretty lucrative venture until the Japanese invaded in 1941 and took their film equipment. After the war, Run Run moved to Hong Kong to get in on the burgeoning film industry there. He and his brothers created Shaw Movie Town, a studio complex where actors lived and worked and cranked out film after film. In their heyday, nearly one a week.
Ramron Shaw was always very frank about the fact that, you know, he didn't really care about it as an art form as much as he cared about it as a business. You know, he saw it as a profitable enterprise. And martial arts is what the people wanted.
And indeed, Shaw had a keen sense for what people wanted. Aside from showcasing martial arts, his films often rehashed old Chinese folktales, as he explained to BBC reporter Alan Wicker in this 1960s documentary.
We have a history of 4,000 years, and most of the stories are known to Chinese. And we have to make those pictures according to those stories.
But these stories didn't only connect with Asian audiences.
The big crossover hits would be things like The One-Armed Swordsman or Come Drink With Me or The 36th Chamber of Shaolin. I mean, you only need to listen to a director like Quentin Tarantino or somebody like that to understand how influential and important these films were.
I was just so influenced by Hong Kong cinema. And to this day, I still think it's like the most invigorating cinema that's made in the world.
In fact, Tarantino put the Shaw Brothers SB logo in the opening credits for his film Kill Bill Volume 1, just one of his many nods to Run Shaw's influence.
Without him and without the martial arts in cinema that he was able to bring to the forefront, we wouldn't have films like The Matrix. The style of fighting used in that film is pure Shaw Brothers. And was actually choreographed by Yuen Woo Ping, who's one of the directors who actually came up and worked his way up through the Shaw Brothers. He did The Matrix and then Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and then Kill Bill. And that pretty much blew the doors off Hong Kong cinema all over again and introduced it to a whole new generation.
You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you?
You know, for a second there, yeah, I kind of did.
Ranma Shaw was knighted in 1977. He even had an asteroid named after him. He died today at his home in Hong Kong. For The World, I'm Nina Porzucchi.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.